An Osho Talk. The Discipline of Transcendence. Talks on the 42 Sutras of Buddha. Volume 3, Number 8.
The first question. I am yearning for the snake to become alive in me, setting me aflame. Am I on a forbidden path? I am scared. The forbidden path is the path. There is no other path. There is a certain rule to evolution, a certain principle to it. And the principle is, before you can become really innocent, you have to lose all innocence. Before you can really become pure, you have to move in all sorts of impurities. Before you can come home, you have to wander, go astray. That's the whole meaning of the Christian parable of Adam being expelled from God's paradise. He had to be expelled. It is not that Adam is responsible for his expulsion. It is a certain basic rule of life. God told Adam that the tree of knowledge is the forbidden tree. You are not supposed to eat from it. Only one commandment was given to him, that he is not to eat from the tree of knowledge. But this functioned as a provocation. If God really wanted him not to eat from the tree of knowledge, the better course would have been that Adam was never told about it. The paradise is infinite. Millions and millions of trees. Even by now, Adam would not have been able to discover it. One tree of knowledge. But the moment God said, don't touch that tree, don't go near it, don't eat it, that tree became the most important tree. Certainly, obviously, Adam must have started dreaming about it. A temptation. Going into the forest, into the garden, again and again the tree will call him. He must have gone close to it, looked, waited, brooded. Many times he must have been just close to it, at the very brink, to commit the sin, to disobey, to be rebellious. There is a fundamental law to it. Adam has to be expelled. Unless Adam is expelled, Adam will never become a Christ. He has to go astray to come home. Very contradictory. But unless you move into sin, you don't know what sainthood is. Every child is a saint. But that sainthood is very cheap. You have not earned it. It is just a natural gift. And who bothers about a natural gift? You have to lose it. When you lose it, you become aware of what you have lost. When you lose it, then you start suffering. Then you feel a great hunger for it. When you lose it, then in contrast, it becomes clear what it was. If you want to see the beautiful dawn, you have to wander into the dark night. Only after the dark night, the morning is beautiful. If you want really to be rich, you have to become poor. Only after poverty, you start feeling the beauty of riches. The contradiction is only apparent, they are complementary. Christians have a theory. They call it felix culpa, a happy fault. Adam's sin has been known to Christian theology as felix culpa, a happy fault, since it brings about the need of Christ the Redeemer. If there has been no disobedience on the part of Adam, then there would have been no Christ. Adam is human consciousness going away from God. Christ is the same human consciousness returning back home. Adam and Christ are not two persons. Adam is the going away. Christ is the coming back. It is the same energy. Disobedience is needed to become obedient. Rebellion is needed to know what surrender is. Ego is needed to become egoless. Every saint has a past and every sinner has a future. Remember it and never be afraid of the forbidden. The forbidden is the path. Go into it. Go courageously. Go totally so that you can finish the attraction. And you are not going to find anything in it. You will come empty out of it. That will be a great experience, a great maturity. Sin can never be fulfilling. So why be afraid? If there was any possibility that sin may fulfill somebody, then there was danger. But sin has never fulfilled anybody. The more you go in it, the more frustrated you are. The more you go in it, the more you know it is just stupid. It is just unintelligent. It is just a old routine rut, a vicious circle. You are not moving anywhere. You are not going anywhere. You are not growing. The more deeply you understand it, the more the possibility that you will start on the backward journey. You will start coming to the original source. Of course, when I say coming back to the original source, I don't mean you will really regress backwards. You will go still onwards, but the journey will turn towards the source. There is no going back. A second childhood comes. In India, we call that second childhood. When a person moves through it, we call him twice born, duja, again born. He has attained to a new birth. He has again become a child, again innocent. So don't be afraid. The world is a temptation. Temptation, you have to go through. Temptation that has to be suffered. And devil is a partner with God. He is not the enemy. He is the partner. He tempts you. He takes you into the forbidden. He helps you to disobey. He provokes you. He allures you. He seduces you. If you go wholeheartedly with him, sooner or later you will understand that he is the deceiver. Immediately he disappears. The moment you realize that the devil is a deceiver, the devil disappears. In that realization is death for him. Suddenly you start laughing. A great laughter arises in you. You start roaring like a lion. A great uproar. Now you have seen the truth. Why God had told you not to eat the fruit of a certain tree. He wanted you to eat. Of course, God cannot be so foolish. If he did not want, then he would have kept quiet. He could have removed the tree. Any ordinary gardener can do that. He did not remove the tree. He simply gave the commandment. And this is very psychological. The parable is really one of the most beautiful psychological parables. Wherever you are not allowed to go, you want to go. If some film is running in the town, and there is an advertisement only for adults, all the children will rush. Then there must be something for them. If it is only for adults, then it has a provocation. Say to people, don't do this, and they will do it. You can be certain about it. And God made it absolutely certain. He must have been a little suspicious about Adam. So he created Eve. Man is a coward. Unless a woman tempts him, he may hesitate. But when a woman is there to tempt, man becomes very brave. When the wife is there, the husband becomes very brave. Never fight with a husband when the wife is present. He will kill you. He has to prove himself because the wife is there. When he is alone, you can fight. He will not bother. He will say it is okay. When you have a woman with you, you become a daredevil. You have to prove to the woman that you are a hero. A great, courageous man. Brave. Then you can be mad. You can do anything. But even then God was suspicious. Maybe the woman is not enough. He created a snake. The snake seduced the woman. The woman seduced Adam. And of course, it was very well planned. It was a beautiful drama, well planned. All the characters are there. Adam can always say, I am not responsible. The Eve, she is responsible. She can always say, I am not responsible. The snake. And of course, the snake cannot speak, so his story ends there. If the snake could speak, he would have said, God is responsible. Nobody has asked the snake, who is responsible? The snake is completely silent. Look, whenever you say, somebody else is responsible, what you are doing, you are simply shifting responsibility. The husband says wife is responsible, the wife says children are responsible, and children of course are dumb, they cannot say anything. So there it stops. We go on throwing responsibility on each other. You become religious the day you recognize I am responsible. Be courageous. Feel your responsibility. And go into all that tempts you. And go fully aware. Go conscious. Go deliberately in it. I would like to tell you another law of life. If you go deliberately into something, it can never become a bondage to you. Don't go as if you are being pulled. Don't go like a slave. Go like a master. Even if you are going into something which is forbidden, which is a declared sin by all the religions, go courageously and go with responsibility. Say that I want to go and I want to explore this dimension and I am going. Don't feel guilty, because if you feel guilty, you will go half-heartedly, and when you go half-heartedly, you are stuck. Then you will never be able to come back. If you go wholeheartedly, you will immediately see the falsity of it, the foolishness of it. Go wholeheartedly and explore it completely, utterly completely. Explore all the corners of it, so it is finished. Once you have seen the whole game, you are out of it. You ask, I am yearning for the snake to become alive in me. The snake is there. God never creates a man without the snake already there. It is built in. It is there. Call it sex, or call it kundalini. It is the snake. Sex is a snake moving downwards. Kundalini is the same snake, the same serpent power, moving upwards. Ordinarily, when a child is born, the snake is there coiled near the sex center, what the yogis call Muladhar. The basic root center, it is coiled there, sleeping energy. At the time when the child becomes mature, sexually mature, at the age of 14 or near about, the snake uncoils and starts going downward towards the valley. That's what sexuality is. One day, when you have explored sexuality and have found nothing worth except trouble, anxiety, anguish, suffering, the snake starts moving upwards. It is the same snake. Now it starts moving towards the peak, towards the mountain. When it starts moving upwards, a great transformation is happening. From Adam, you are becoming a Christ. And when the snake has hit the ultimate in you, Sahasrar, the seventh chakra of your being, the highest peak, the Everest, the Gauri Shankar. When it has hit that chakra, suddenly you are neither Adam nor Christ. You are God Himself. To feel oneself as an Adam is a dream. Nightmares. To feel oneself as the Christ is still a dream, better than the first. Not nightmares at all. Very sweet and beautiful. Tremendously beautiful. But still a dream. To come to know oneself as God is to come to reality, is to come home. The snake is there, and it is very much alive. You may have become afraid about the snake. The society is working just against you. The society does not want you to be an individual aflame with energy. The society wants you to remain in control. The society is afraid. Even a single individual can become very explosive. That's what happened when a Christ moved on the earth, or a Buddha. just as a small atom can explode and can destroy a whole big city like Hiroshima, a just tiny atom, invisible by eyes, nobody has ever seen it, not even visible by instruments, an invisible particle can explode and can generate so much energy. What to say about a human consciousness? If a human consciousness explodes, the society does not know how to control it. The society keeps you plugged to the lowest rung. It does not allow you to move. It keeps you just on the earth. It never gives you wing. You have the wings, but it does not even make you aware that you have the wings. It teaches you everything, but the most basic is not taught. In the university, your head is stuffed with rubbish. In schools, colleges, in universities, your head is used as a dustbin. People go on throwing things. They are taking revenge with their own teachers. They have filled their heads with straw. Now they are doing the same with others. And religiously. Very seriously. Have you seen professors, chancellors, vice chancellors? So serious. As if they are doing a great service to humanity. They are simply destroying. When the head becomes too heavy, you lose contact with your heart. When the head becomes too much important, you tend to forget about the heart. And heart is the source of your life energies. From the heart you are connected to the sex center. And from the heart you are connected to Sahasrar. Heart is the bridge between the sex and Sahasrar. Heart is the bridge between the valley and the peak. And they go on stuffing your head. They train your head so much. You become so clever. You become so efficient with the head that you simply bypass the route that goes through the heart. Life moves through the heart. The snake is alive, but your heart is closed. The snake is alive and ready to jump on its journey. Just you will have to open the doors of your heart. That's what I mean when I say dance, sing, be ecstatic, celebrate, love, feel. The real university of the future will be a training center for the heart, not for the head. These universities that exist today are just out of date. They are just ruins of the past. They can exist in the museums, but they should not be allowed to exist anymore in reality. The real university has to be a great training for the heart, for the feeling. Your snake is alive. Just open your heart. Your snake is groping. When I see into you, when you come to me, and I personally encounter you, I see the snake groping for the heart. Towards the head, it cannot go without moving from the heart. There is no way. It can go only to the head, through the heart. When it goes through the heart, it does not reach to your reason. It reaches to your intuition. When it goes through the heart, it hits the Sahasrar. The Sahasrar is also in the head. But it is not the head that you are aware of. Even biologists, physiologists say that half of the head simply seems to be useless. What is the function of it? Only half seems to work. The other half, which seems useless and non-functioning, is the seat of the Sahasrar. When you move, your energy moves through the heart, it reaches to the other half of the head, which is ordinarily not functioning. It functions only when a man becomes a Buddha. And I will repeat again, the forbidden path is the only path. Be courageous. Remember, sin is a felix culpa, a happy fault, because that is the only way one comes to become a saint. The second question. This drama has occupied me since the transference of the towel. You passed your towel to sannyasin saying that it will descend like God, but it landed on the floor. Then yesterday again you have taken it back. Buddha transferred the flower of Mahakashyap, the flower to Mahakashyap, which is still with him. Is there no one out of all sannyasins which can receive your towel? Please say something and clear it clearly. But the question is unsigned. It must be from a coward. My whole feeling is not to answer it. Because if you cannot even declare your name, you are afraid even to ask a question. You are afraid. You don't want to expose yourself, even before me. My feeling is not to answer it, but the question is good. The person may be coward. So I am not answering the questioner, I will answer the question. The mind can look at things always in two ways. Remember it. The mind can look in a negative way. The mind can look in a positive way. And the religious person is one who tries to find out the positive door. Because through the negative, you never reach to the real. The real is always positive. And the positive person uses even the negativity to find the positive. But the goal remains the positive. For example, this happened. I told you, wait for the towel. It will descend like a god on somebody's head. But it descended on the floor. Now there are two possibilities. One, either nobody is ready to receive it, or so many are ready, so the towel is in a difficulty. But the negative mind always looks from the negative. That's what I would like to say to you. I have many more Mahakashyapas than Buddha had. And the towel was in a difficulty. Worried it hit the beam. Where to descend? On whom? It would have been unjust to choose one and not to choose the other. In the whole history of humanity, there has never been such laughter as there is around me. When Buddha was holding the flower in his hand, only one sannyasin, Mahakashyap, smiled. Hence, the flower was transferred to him. All were long-faced people, sad, must be thinking esoterically. That what does it mean? It means nothing. It is simply a meaningless gesture. Mahakashyap laughed, looking at the whole ridiculousness of it. He laughed not at the flower. He laughed not at Buddha. He laughed all those fools who had around, surrounded there. Just they were thinking, what is it is? And they must be going round about in their heads and spinning theories and looking into scriptures and into memories in the past. Has there been any precedent before? And they must be trying to find out some hidden meaning in it. There is nothing hidden in it. A Buddha is as open as a flower. There is nothing hidden in it. Buddhists have a saying from Buddha that there is nothing hidden in existence. From the very beginning there is nothing hidden. Everything is just in front of you. Just you need to open your eyes. Seeing the whole absurdity of the so-called great scholars that surrounded Buddha, great pundits, logicians, Mahakashyap laughed. Buddha called him and gave him his flower. And he said to his disciples, whatsoever can be said, I have told to you. That which cannot be said, I transfer to Mahakashyap. Now again, for 2,500 years, those foolish scholars and pundits are again thinking, what happened? They are again thinking, what transpired between Buddha and Mahakashyap? What was delivered? In Zen, the masters give this as a koan. They say to their disciples, sit silently and find out the answer. Why Buddha chose Mahakashyap? Why Mahakashyap laughed? Why the flower was given to him? And what Buddha means when he says, that which cannot be said, I am delivering it to Mahakashyap. And that which can be said, I have told to you. Of course, truth cannot be said. So Buddha is delivering truth to Mahakashyap. And all that can be said about truth is again a beautiful lie. So Buddha has said lies to others and truth has been given to Mahakashyap. And Mahakashyap was not one of the most prominent disciples. Not at all. In fact, nobody hears his name except in this story. Sariputta was a great scholar. Moggallan was a great scholar. Ananda was the chief disciple. And there were many. Mahakashyap, nobody has ever heard about him, must have lived a very silent life, unobtrusive, unpretending, must have been a nobody. But only a nobody can laugh. And must have seen through the whole stupidity of the scholars. Zen masters say to their disciples, think about it, meditate over it, contemplate, and bring the answer. And disciples go and meditate and bring answers. And all answers are wrong. One day, after years, it happens sometimes after 20 years, there are stories on record that a disciple meditated for 20 years, came again and again, every month, twice a year, then once a year, will find a great answer, will create a philosophy around it, and will bring it to, and the master will say, from the very beginning, just seeing the disciple, he said, wrong. And he has not said anything yet. Because it is not a question that you can bring an answer. Your face shows it, that you are serious. And he will say, wrong. The disciple became very worried and he said, but what this does mean? I have not even said anything. And the master will say, it is not a question of saying or not saying. The way you come, the way you hold your head, the way your face looks, the question is still there. You cannot deceive me. Then 20 years pass, and one day he comes, giggling. And the master says, so you have got it? Now the seriousness has disappeared. Now he have understood the point. It is not a question of philosophy. He has understood the point that for these 19 years he has been following Sariputta, Moggallan, Ananda, those serious faces. Now he has understood that it is nothing. It is just a joke. Buddha played a game, and only a Buddha can play such a beautiful game. Now you ask why the towel did not descend on somebody's head. I have so many laughing Mahakashyapas and very few Sariputtas, very few scholars and pandits. My whole effort is to bring laughter to religion. I would like you to laugh your way to God. And unless you reach laughing, you will not be allowed, you will not be welcomed, you will not be accepted. And I would suggest you one thing. If you go to God, rather than taking a prayer with you, take a joke. He always waits for people who can say a good joke to him. And then he laughs. And in his laughter is grace. And in his laughter is benediction. But for the next time, I would like the questioner to sign his name. People would have enjoyed your name. They would have laughed. At least don't deceive here. You deceive everywhere. A man threw a rupee to a blind beggar who expertly retrieved it. The man was astonished. I thought you were blind. And there was a sign in front of the beggar that I am blind. No, sir. I am not that blind beggar who usually sits here. Today, his day is off. And he has gone to see the movie. In fact, I am his friend. I am just tending his shop. Really, I am deaf and dumb. This is how things are. You go on deceiving. You go on pretending that you are somebody else. You have many faces. And your original face is lost in your so many masks. And unless you recognize your original face, you will not be able to reach anywhere. You will not have any meaning to your life. You will miss this opportunity. This life is only for those who are real. Your facade, your mask has to be dropped. My whole effort is to go on hammering so that it becomes a little loose and your real face starts coming up. You will be surprised yourself because your real face is the face of God Himself. The mask is yours. The falsity is yours. Ordinarily, you don't exist as a real person. You are a mythology. You are a myth, not reality. This word, mythology, is beautiful. It comes from a Latin root, myth. And myth comes from a Sanskrit root, mithya. Mithya means the false, the unreal, the fictitious. From mithya comes myth, from myth comes mythology. You are a myth. You are a mythology. You are just a fiction. You are not real. And how the fiction can meet God? The fiction can meet only another fiction. Only real can meet the real. The similar can meet the similar. So drop your mask. Come into the open. When I ask that your questions should be signed, that simply means that you accept that the question is yours, that you accept the responsibility of asking it. And if I ridicule the question, I prove that the question is stupid, you accept it, that it is your question. And you accept the ridicule. And you are not hurt about it. Because this is a surgical operation. If you start crying and weeping, and you don't allow me to operate, then take your fee back. Because then it is meaningless. Why you are lying down on the operation table? The day you become a sannyasin, you will remain on the operation table. Unless I have succeeded in cutting your head completely. But you are very clever. You are very political. But remember that the politician is the most stupid man. Let me tell you one anecdote. Mulla Nasruddin decides he needs a brain. So he goes to the brain bank. The caretaker shows him the bottled brain of a great mathematician for 600 rupees only. Too expensive, Mulla says. The caretaker leads him to the brain of a nuclear physicist for 9,000 rupees. Much too expensive, Mulla replies. Finally, the caretaker offers him the brain of a politician for 20,000 rupees. Why should I pay that kind of money for the brain of a politician? Mulla protests. But sir, the caretaker explains, this brain has never been used. The politician never uses his brain. To deceive, much brain is not needed. To be true, much brain is needed. To cheat, much brain is not needed. Very ordinary, very low IQ. But to be honest, to be true, to be totally nude in the open, great intelligence is needed. The fourth question. Why do you appear to give more attention to Westerners and on the whole to almost ignore Indians? I am thinking especially when you give sannyas. This question is very important and has to be understood both by Indians and non-Indians. When a Westerner comes to me, I had to approach him through his head, because there is no entry, no other entry possible. When an Indian comes to me, a simpler approach is possible through the heart. When an Indian comes to me, he comes for satsang. He wants just to be in my presence. He has no questions. And those Indians who have questions, they never come to me. I have created too many barriers for them to come. Those Indians whose minds are too much stuffed, they don't come to me. And I don't want them here. I have made every possible effort to prevent them from coming to me. I am not interested in them. The Indians that come to me, come to be with me, silently. They can understand the language of silence. But when a Westerner comes, he cannot understand the language of silence. He can understand only the language of logic. So I have to talk. I have to talk too much to the Westerners. By and by, I persuade them to become silent. By and by, they also become Indians. But it takes time. For a spectator, it may appear as if I am not paying attention to the Indians. And the question is from a Westerner. You may see that when an Indian comes to take sannyas, I simply give him sannyas. Even if I ask him, has he something to ask, he says no. Sometimes I even don't ask him. I can see that he has not come to ask any question. He has come to be with me. And that is far more significant, far more deep. He has come just to see me, just to be with me. He wants a bridge in silence. But to a watcher, it will look that I am not paying much attention. Because when I talk, then you think I am paying attention. When I talk for half an hour to one person, of course you think I have been too much attentive to him. That simply shows that the person is too much in the head, and I have to persuade him. The Western mind is only mind. It has forgotten the heart. The Eastern mind is not only mind. The heart is still predominant, fortunately. The mind is secondary. So there is no need to talk much. He touches my feet and he is happy. He is tremendously happy. He has touched something real. He has touched something from the unknown. To a Westerner it seems just meaningless. Then why you have come? Just to touch the feet? Just to sit silently? Silently you can sit at your home. Then why you travel so long? The Western knows only one way of communication, and that is through language, through logic, reason. I have to convince him. The Indian needs no conviction. He is convinced about the fact of sannyas. If he has not taken sannyas, it is not that he is not convinced. It is only that he is not courageous enough. He wants a little courage. Convinced he is. Convinced he is for many lives that sannyas is the only way to be rightly in existence. Sannyas is the only way to reach God, to reach truth. He is convinced that is in the blood and in the bones. An Indian is born with the desire to be a sannyasin. He may not be able to dare. That's another thing. So when he comes to me, he has not come for any conviction. Conviction is already there. He has come to me just to feel my vibe, so that he can gather a little more courage and take the jump. When a Westerner comes, he is not convinced at all. Sannyas seems just outlandish, bizarre, eccentric. For the Westerner, sannyas simply makes no appeal. He has never thought about it. So many Western sannyasins are here. Have you had ever any dream in your life that you will become a sannyasin? Even now that you have become a sannyasin, you are puzzled what has happened to you. What you are doing here, such an intelligent person, what he is doing here? Ask Hiren. He is continuously thinking. Such an intelligent person, almost a Jew, what he is doing here? He should be somewhere in the London market, earning more and more money, having bigger and bigger houses. What he is doing here? Just jumping and dancing like a fool? The Westerner comes to me without any conviction, without any idea what sannyas is. I have to talk him into it. I have to pull him into it. And I have to be very logical. I use logic only for Westerners. For Indians, I use magic. And these are two different approaches. The fifth question. Lately I feel you have been throwing us back on ourselves more and more. Where else I should throw you? That is the only place. That's where you belong. The whole effort of a master is to bring you back home, to throw you back to yourself, to make you that which you are meant to be, to help you to be yourself. If there is some teacher who pretends to make you somebody else, beware, escape from him. He is like poison. He will destroy you. I am not trying to make you into something else that you are not. I am simply helping you to be yourself. Whosoever you are, whosoever Allah wills you to be. I can only cooperate with the will of Allah. I am not here to interfere. Whatsoever you are going to be, whatsoever is your destiny, I simply help you towards that destiny. I don't interfere. One day suddenly you will see you have become absolutely independent, absolutely your own authentic being. That will be day for my happiness. And that will be day for your gratitude. You will feel grateful. That day you will understand why I continue to throw you back to yourself. I don't want to become a crutch to you. I would like your own limbs to be strong enough. I don't want to be a crutch. I don't want to become your eyes. Because that will be impossible. You will be deceived. I don't want to give you what I know, In the first place, it cannot be given. In the second place, if it is given, it is immediately corrupted. The moment it reaches you, it mixes with you, it is corrupt. Knowledge is possible only when your eyes open, when it is your own vision, when you have the clarity. I am not giving you answers. I am simply trying to take away the questions. Remember it. I am not giving you any answers. That's why my answers are so elusive, so roundabout. I simply want to take away the thorn of question from your heart. My answer is just a trick. Once the questions have disappeared, you are the answer. And there are not many answers, remember, there is only one answer, because there is only one life and there is only one question. Because you don't know the one answer, you go on asking 1,001 questions. I am not supplying you any answers. In fact, I am pulling the very earth beneath you. I will leave you hanging into the abyss, bottomless abyss. You will be scared. My whole work is to help you not to get scared, to help you to keep courage. Because once you allow yourself to fall into the abyss, questionless mind, thoughtless mind is an abyss. Because it is in no mind. When the question is not, where is the mind? Then the mind has disappeared. And with the mind disappears the ego. And with the mind disappear I and you. With the mind disappears the master and the disciple. With the mind disappear all distinctions. You start falling. If you allow me and if you cooperate with me, I would help you to fall like a feather slowly into the empty abyss of being. That is the answer. The answer is your being. The questions come from your mind. The mind is not your being. Be mindless. Be beyond mind. You would like to cling to me because that is very cheap and easy. You can throw all your responsibility on me. You can say, no, you take care. And you can go on living your life the way you were living. That's what people do in the world. They choose a master, they surrender, and they say, now, I'm finished. Now you take care of me. And they go on living the same way, the same dishonesty, the same distrust, the same falsity, the same myth, they continue. As if they have done all that they were needed to do. This won't help. Surrender is not throwing away of responsibility. Surrender is simply an indication of trust, that you trust this man. Now whatsoever he is going to say, you are going to do. Surrender is the beginning of a great effort. Surrender is the beginning of a great journey. Surrender is getting into the stream. When you surrender to me, you simply surrender to me so that I can make you yourself. You have tried in your own way and you have failed. You have tried and followed many people and you have failed. Because those people were not interested really in you. They were interested in their own idea. Somebody was trying to become a Christian. Somebody was trying to make you a Hindu. Somebody was trying to change you into a Mohammedan. They were interested in their own ways. They had their own ideas to impose on you. You were victims. With me, I am not trying to make you a Christian or a Hindu or a Jaina or a Buddhist. I am simply trying to make just the one that you are meant to be, that God wants you to be. That's why I go on answering different people in a different way, different ways. Later on you will not be able to figure out what type of man was this, what manner of man was this. If you will look through all of my books, you will not be able to sort it out, what system. There is no system. Because my approach is individual. I say one thing to one person and immediately just the opposite to another person. Just the last night, to one I said that you become a Buddhist monk. That you be completely out of your sexuality. Forget about it. And immediately after him, to other person I said, you indulge. You move into relationship. Now it will be difficult for anybody to sort out what type of system is this. My approach is individual. I talk to one person, then I forget the whole world. And when I talk to the person, I am not important. That person is important. When I talk to a person, I don't talk out of an ideology. I don't have a ready-made system. I don't try to fix that person in that system, because that will be inhuman. That is violence. And whenever you find a saint trying to fix you into some system, trying to force you into some system, remember, he is a murderer. He is very violent. His violence may have a sugar coating to it. Your so-called Mahatmas are like that. Very violent. Tremendously violent people. Trying to fix you into a mold. The mold is prefabricated. The mold is already there when you have not been there. When you come, the mold is there. You have to fit with the mold. When you come to me, I have no mold. I don't fit you into something. I simply look into you. And I try to see where your innermost energy is moving. And I help it to move in that direction. That is your way. That's where you should be. You are not courageous to move in it. I help you. I give you courage. I give you promise that I am with you. You go. You don't be worried. But I help you to be yourself. And to me, religion means freedom to each individual. Absolute freedom to each individual. Of course, in that freedom, a great discipline is implied. But that discipline has to arise out of your own consciousness. It has not to be imposed by anybody else. But right now, when you are in the process, you may not be able to understand it totally. The day you will arrive, then you will understand what this man was doing to you. You will feel grateful. There is a story about a Chinese monk who was celebrating. Somebody asked, why you are celebrating? What has happened? He said, this is my master's birthday. The master has died. But the questioner was worried. He said, but as far as I remember, you approached that master many times and he always refused to become your master. So why you are celebrating? Because this ceremony is to be done only by a disciple who has been accepted by the master. So why you are bothering? In fact, he rejected you so many times. The man started laughing. He said, because he rejected me, I fell upon myself. And the day I realized my being, I felt grateful to him. He is my master. If he had not rejected me, I may not have arrived. Because in fact, I was trying to find some support, somebody to lean to. I was not really interested in becoming absolutely individual and free. I was talking about liberation, but I was not really trying to be liberated. I was trying to find out a beautiful cage, a beautiful prison, some holy prison, some religious pattern. But this man was simply incredible. How many times I approached him and he will just throw me out and he will say, go home, I'm not your master. And now I know he was my master and this was his teaching. His rejection was his acceptance, because he could see through me that this is the only way I can grow. That's why he rejected me. But by rejecting me, he accepted me. Can you see the point of it? I will go on throwing you upon yourself. Sometimes you will feel hurt. Sometimes a great pain will arise in you. But one day, finally when you come home, you will be thankful that I never became a crutch to you. The sixth question, you made me realize that I was a coward and I accepted it and was happy. Now I am getting a feeling that I am becoming brave and I am scared. It is from Rajbharati. He is an army man. And of course he used to believe that he is a brave man. But he may have entered the army only to have this feeling of being a brave man. He is a colonel, so he has credentials. He can prove that he is brave. But I looked into him and I saw that he is a coward. And he was brave enough to accept it. He accepted it without any complaint, without any grudge. He accepted it totally. That was beautiful. When he accepted it, that very moment I knew that now he will become brave. Because this is the beginning of bravery. Only a brave man can accept that he is a coward. Cowards can never accept it. Cowards try to prove that they are brave. I had one teacher who continuously tried to prove that he is a very brave man. I approached him and I said, you stop this nonsense. You talk so much about bravery, I have a suspicion that you are a coward. And if you don't stop it, I will create trouble. He said, what do you mean? I said, you leap to me. But you stop immediately because I know you are a coward. I have seen you trembling in the class. When you enter the class, you perspire. And you talk about bravery, you immediately stop it. Otherwise, you will have to prove that you are a brave man. And it is going to be difficult. Not only he stopped, he simply disappeared. He resigned from his post. After a few years, when I was in the university, I came across on a railway station. I said, where you have been? He said, you are dangerous. I am really a coward man. But when you said that I will have to prove, and I started thinking about it, I said, better get out from here. Colonel Raj accepted it so simply, so innocently, that very moment he started becoming brave. This is the logic of life. It is very absurd logic. A coward goes on trying that he is brave. A brave man accepts even his cowardice. A violent man tries to become non-violent. A really non-violent man accepts all violence that is inside him. A very sexual man goes on trying to become celibate. A real celibate accepts all the sexuality that is in him. A sinner goes on pretending to be a saint. A real saint is one who knows how many possibilities of getting into sin are still alive in him. Now he says, now I am getting a feeling that I am becoming brave and I am scared. Again you are getting into the old rut. When you were coward, you accepted that you were a coward man and you started becoming brave. Now you are started feeling that you are brave and you are becoming coward. You are scared. See the logic of it. Never claim that you are brave and you will remain brave. Never claim that you are beautiful and you will remain beautiful. Never claim that you are wise and you will remain wise. The moment you claim, you have fallen into the trap again. The Upanishads say, the one who knows never says that he knows. The one who says he knows does not know. So see the game of the mind. Just watch. Don't start believing that you are brave. Otherwise you will become a coward again. But if you can watch this whole game and you can remain just a witness, then cowardice, bravery all disappear. And that which is left is the real you. It is neither. It is transcendental. The sixth question, you tell us every day to surrender, yet it still does not happen. Why not? I really want to let go, yet trying does not work. Neither does not trying. What to do and when, if ever, will it happen? It is not a question of your doing or of your not doing, because not doing is also your doing. It is not a question of doing at all, positively or negatively. When you are neither doing nor not doing, then it happens. You move from one polarity to another. First you try to do. When it doesn't happen, you say, okay, so I will not do now. Let us see whether it happens or not. But the expectation is the same. It was behind doing, now it is behind non-doing. You are expecting it to happen. You are desiring it to happen. You are hoping it to happen. Unless the desire disappears, unless the hope is abandoned, it will not happen. Surrender happens only when the desire, the hope, disappears. In total abandon, it happens. So neither your doing is needed, nor your non-doing is needed, because both are not different basically. Behind both is the same desire. Let me tell you one anecdote. Mullah Nasruddin had to drive his wife and mother-in-law from Bombay to Pune. And all along the way, the two women in his life were giving advice on how to drive. Finally, Nasruddin could not take it anymore and pulled the car to the side of the road and furiously turned to his wife in the back seat and whined, "All right, now let us get this straight once and for all. Who is driving this car? You or your mother?" But whether the mother decides or the wife decides, it is all the same, somebody else is deciding. whether you try to let it happen by doing, or you allow it to happen by not doing, but you don't allow God any chance. Surrender is a gift from God. When you are completely absent, neither doing nor not doing, it happens. But it has nothing to do with you, so you can completely forget about it. You simply do your ordinary things. Eat, sleep, walk, dance, sing, love. You do your ordinary things. And you just forget all about surrender. One day suddenly it is there. Doing the ordinary things of life, not waiting for any extraordinary happening, not waiting for some miracle, one day it is there. It's simply there. One morning you rise and it is there. Your whole room is full of a benediction. And after that, you cannot lose it. There is no way to lose it. Because really in surrender, what actually happens is your own nature comes to a flowering. But it is a God's gift. Even pray not for it. Because in your prayer also there will be desire. The seventh question. I went in search of Mullah Nasruddin and could not find him. So upon your suggestion, I looked up Yog Chinmaya and asked him why you threw your toggle. He gave a half-hour long discourse on the deeply symbolic and highly esoteric reasons. I came away laughing. You tricked us again. Yog Chinmaya is Mullah Nasruddin. He is trying hard, but he is not yet. It is a very difficult thing to be Mullah Nasruddin. To be Mullah Nasruddin means two things. Be foolish in your wisdom and be wise in your foolishness. It is a very great contradiction. Be wise in your foolishness and be foolish in your wisdom. Yoga Chinmaya is trying hard, but only the second part he has been able to do up to now. The first part is more difficult. If he goes on working hard at it, he may succeed. You should be aware of the fact that Mullah Nasruddin is a Sufi device. It is to make you clear that life is wise in its foolishness. And when you try to be wise, you become a fool. The greatest wise people are like fools. And the greatest foolish people are those who pretend that they are wise. Socrates has said that when I was not aware, when I was ignorant, I used to think that I know. When I was ignorant, I used to think I know. Now that I know only one thing, that I know not. In the tremendous flowering of wisdom, one becomes a fool. Jesus is a fool. Saint Francis is a fool. Buddha is a fool. Their ignorance is profound. Their ignorance is ultimate. In their ignorance, they declare that the life is a mystery, immeasurable. infinite. There is no way to solve it. It is not a problem to be solved. It is a mystery to be lived. In their ignorance, they have become absolutely innocent. That is their wisdom. Then you go to the great philosophers, Hegel, Kant, Aristotle, Plato. They prove that they are very wise. That is their foolishness. If you have to choose, choose the fool and you will become wise. Don't choose to pretend wisdom, otherwise you will become a fool. One day I was walking with Mullah Nasruddin on the road. It suddenly started raining. I told Mullah Nasruddin, "Mullah, it is raining, open your umbrella." He said, "Would not do any good, it is full of holes." So I was surprised. I said, "So why are you carrying it? Why you brought it in the first place?" He said, "I didn't think it would rain." There is this busy hospital, clinic, where patients can come for free medical treatment. Lots of elderly people who have nothing to do just come to tell the doctor their troubles. Mullah Nasruddin went every day. There was nothing wrong with him, but the doctors humored him, listened patiently, and actually looked forward to his visits. One day, he did not show up. Next day, his doctor asked, "Where were you yesterday? We missed you." "I will tell you the truth," he replied. "I was sick." Mullah Nasruddin is so content and so happy. I one day asked, "What's your philosophy, Nasruddin? How you avoid worries?" He said, "This is my philosophy in short. Life is very simple. The first thing to remember about life is don't worry about it. Really, there are only two things to worry about. Either you are successful or you are not successful. If you are successful, there is nothing to worry about. If you are not successful, there is only two things to worry about. Either you are healthy or you are unhealthy. If your health is good, there is nothing to worry about. If your health is bad, there are only two things to worry about. Either you are going to live or you are not going to live. If you live, there is nothing to worry about. And if you don't live, why? You have only two things to worry about. Either you are going to heaven or you are not going to heaven. If you go to heaven, there is nothing to worry about. And if you go to the other place, you will be so doggone busy shaking hands with all your old friends, you won't have time to worry." I hope and bless Yog Chinmay someday. He will become Mullah Nasruddin. The day one becomes Mullah Nasruddin, one has arrived home. The drunk Mullah Nasruddin was stopped by a policeman as he staggered about the street at 3 o'clock in the morning. "Can you explain why you are out at this time?" asked the policeman. "If I could," said the mullah, "I would be home by now." If you know what life is, you will be home by now. All esoteric explanations, all explanations as such, are foolish. Chinmay is doing well as far as 50% Mullah Nasruddin is concerned. All explanations are foolish. Because all so-called wisdom is foolish. But this is how one grows. The other 50% will also be coming. when foolishness becomes wisdom. The last question. Very mysterious things are happening. A towel has been found in the question box, and we do not know from where it has come. Could you please enlighten us? Certainly, mysterious things are happening. That's what Yogi Chinma said to his chief disciple Priya just 2 days before, that many mysterious things are happening. And he said day before yesterday, the day after tomorrow, many more mysterious things are going to happen. Today is that day after tomorrow. And now this has happened. Now it is absolutely difficult to use logic. I will have to use magic. Give me a little moment, a little time to use my magic. The towel is from a woman. Indian, not Western. Married, not unmarried. A sannyasin. Her name starts with U. And if you want more information about her, you can inquire care of Colonel Raj Bharti. Enough for today.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.